What's that number that's unlucky?
13.
13. If you can remember, 13 is often regarded as an unlucky number. You have an easy way to remember where 666, the mark of the beast, and the other things are in the Bible. And this is, of course, at the end of the chapter, Revelation 13, verses 16 through 18. Today we want to focus on verses 16 and 17. Now, prior to this time, beginning back there in 13:1, John talked about the first beast. He says, and we think that was the devil. He was standing upon the sea, the sand there, and I saw a beast coming up out of the sea. That first beast we identified as an evil civil power. For those in John's day, we think this would have been Rome. And then later through the chapter, he talks about another beast. We interpreted that as evil religious power, false religion, and Rome had that as well. So for the first Christians, these would have been the maybe initial applications of that, and we've seen these things throughout time as far as civil authority that's persecuted God's people and also false religion that Satan has been able to use. So John continues to talk about these things, and then as we get down to 16 and 17, things change a little bit. In 16, he says, and he, still talking about, the beast, the false, the evil that Satan has used to persecute God's people, he causeth all, the small and the great and the rich and poor and the free and bond, and there be given them a mark on their right hand or upon their forehead, and that no man should be able to buy or to sell, save or except he that hath the mark, even the name of the beast and the number of his name. And then, of course, 666 is where we pick up with verse 18. All right, now we mentioned the two beasts, and now as we continue the thought, John says all. And then he breaks that down a little bit. He says the small, the great, the rich, the poor, the free, the bond. Each one, he says, receive what? Was supposed to receive a? Receive a mark. And then, of course, he breaks that down a little bit. He says the mark hand being where? On their
forehead.
Well, on the forehead was one area, or also upon the right hand. So those places. And that, of course, would show submission to that ungodly power. Today, we still do the same kind of thing, don't we? You think about the farmer. Does he mark any of his livestock? All right, you've got the cattle brand out there, and that's Ranch X, or it's this particular farm that is tied in with this particular stock and so forth. So that's really what we see here. Then you have also the general thought in verse 17, who is going to be able to buy or sell without the mark? Nobody. I mean, this was something that was really all locked up tight. You either had to be with the program or you were not going to fare very well. Now, as I mentioned, a mark is usually used to identify someone or something. John uses this word that's translated mark multiple times in this particular book, about seven times, and it described in ancient times something that was engraved, something that was imprinted, something that was branded, as I mentioned, like a horse, or it could be the mark on a document. We see seals sometimes. They may say we have to have a certified birth certificate, and unless you have that raised seal, that raised stamp, they're going to say that's not going to cut it. You have to make sure that it's been certified by a notary. You need it notarized. So this kind of thing is not new. Now, there's no way to be for sure as far as what the mark was. And we'll make the same point when we deal with the mark of the beast a little bit later in verse 18. But there are some suggestions, I think, which fit in well with the context of the book and at least will give us the general idea. I mean, we can understand that the mark's not a good thing. But there are some things, I think, that are worthy of consideration. One suggestion that I think has some value would be coinage, currency. If you look at our currency today, there's some things that stand out. For example, we say, in God we trust. But if you looked at Roman coins, you think they'd say something about God? Yeah, and not God in the sense of you're thinking of, Jehovah God, not like our currency, but Betty got the other aspect of that. It would say something about God, and the guy who's sitting on the throne, who's he? He's God. Well, you didn't really believe that if you were a Christian, but every time he used that currency, you were, in essence, acknowledging that Caesar was Lord. Today, we find the same kind of thing. It's offensive. Our currency is offensive. I mean, they're willing to take it and use it, but it's offensive to atheists, to people who don't believe in God. One nation under God is just like every dollar they have to handle. It's very, very distasteful to them. Well, if you look at this not from an atheist standpoint, but from a Christian standpoint, you're touching, you're using money that acknowledges that another person, a human being, is deity. And for a Christian, I mean, that could have been very, very offensive. Really, it would fall into the area of blasphemy. And if you think about this, John talks about which hand was the mark on? The right hand. Most people, if they're going to pay for something? Right hand or left? Most people are right-handed. So when they transact business, typically it's going to be this hand, the right hand. And then as far as the forehead, you may have seen some pictures. We probably don't see it too often in this particular country. Sometimes you'll see a woman. She's been to various countries and she's gotten coins from various countries and she'll turn it into a little bracelet. Anybody ever see that? I've seen that a few times in my life, some ladies who travel quite a bit. But if you go back and you look at history, sometimes women would wear a headband. And that headband consisted of coins. So, you know, once again, this may not be for sure what John described, but it certainly fits very, very well. So, as I said, when Christians were using the currency, to them that may have seemed like blasphemy, and it would have been very difficult not to have used the currency. Let's say, for example, that the atheist in our country is so offended by "In God We Trust." He says, well, I'm not going to use American currency. I'm going to use the yen. I'm going to use the peso. How well is he going to fare? I mean, I don't want to take it. You can go down to the bank and probably get it exchanged because of the time in which we live. But, you know, you're not going to be able to check out at McDonald's with yens and pesos. It's just not going to cut it. Now, we have some other options as far as you could probably use a debit card and you could use a credit card and so forth. But for these people, you know, this was the system that Rome had arranged. And if you were going to buy, if you were going to sell, if you were going to trade, then, of course, this was the system that you had to use. And it was very, very difficult. Now, think about this. If you're a Christian, you're living in Rome, you are supposed to use the money, and you have stringent objections to that. How are the Romans going to view you? You reject the currency. Does that make you look like a loyal citizen or a disloyal citizen? Yeah, you really look like a dissident at that particular point. You know, you can imagine atheists. It's one thing to say, we don't like it, and we object to it. It's another thing to say, we're not going to use it. If you've got several people that stand up and say that, it's probably going to get some attention. You're going to make the national news, if you will. So when you go back and you look at how Rome viewed Christians, it's not difficult, as one source said, to see that they did not regard these people as just heretics. They regarded them as Jeff was saying, dissidents, dangerous revolutionaries who would not take the oath of loyalty to the empire. The result was that every Christian was automatically an outlaw. So I can say this may be part of the thought, it may be the primary thought, maybe we're off base a little bit, but it is one of the things that deserves attention. If you've ever studied the book of Revelation, you may have come across something else. There is some evidence, and I'll read you an example of this, but there's some evidence for believing that people in this day and time, because of what was going on, you were asked, presumably once a year, to pinch a little incense to the gods. And once you did that, you got your certificate. Now today, we still do the same kind of thing. A person goes down to the driver's license clinic, they pay a few bucks and, you know, get asked some questions, take a couple tests, and then you get your driver's license. If you're stopped, you're asked to produce your license, and that you know, says that, okay, you've been authorized to drive in the state of Indiana and, you know, throughout the U.S. and whatnot. And as I said, there seems to be some proof that this same kind of thing was being done in this day and time. And here is some information about this. One source said, we've got a document, a certificate, and it says, to those who have been appointed to preside over the sacrifices. And then it gives the names of the family, the mom, dad, and the children, so forth, and where they live. It says, we have always sacrificed to the gods. And now in your presence, according to the regulations, we have sacrificed and offered libations and tasted the sacred things. And we ask you to give us certification for having done so. May you fare well. So here's a family, presumably a pagan family. They have done what Rome has asked, and they say, give us the certification. Well, with that certification, what could you now do? You've done what Rome's required, so now Rome says, okay, you're now approved to buy, sell, trade, because you've acknowledged the empire. And then, of course, as you look at the document, it says, we, the representatives of the empire, have seen you sacrificing, and here is your certificate, and so forth. So this is, once again, you know, something that would have involved financial transactions, something that apparently many, if not most, or all the people in the empire needed. And for the Christian, that really was unthinkable. Bad enough to be forced to use the currency, but when you're asked to, you know, sacrifice to the gods to get this certificate so you can buy, sell, and trade, then it really becomes very, very hard. It's not difficult to imagine some circumstances as far as how this played out. Let's suppose that you're a farmer, and you know it's a kind of the wrong time of year for this illustration, but your crop has been very productive. And you go out and you want to sell your crop. So you go down to the local market and you say, hey, I want to go ahead and sell my crop. I've got some great tomatoes and I've got some good green beans and some other things here. And look at my cucumbers. And what does the fellow at the market say? Hey, that produce is good, but I need your certificate. Show me, I'm a Christian. And then Betty got it right. I can't go ahead and buy from you. And you can see how that would also function in reverse, can't you? You go down to the market and you want to buy the information. You're willing to pay what they ask. And you get up there to the checkout line and they say, okay, where's your certificate? Well, I don't have one. I've got money. Can't do it. You need to go ahead and offer us a certificate, or we're not going to trade with you. So there may have been some exceptions, but for the most part, this would have been a very, very difficult thing. Now, when people today look at this particular thing, they forget about, oftentimes, the things that we covered, what things were like, and really the context of Revelation. That is, we've got a symbolic book with a lot of information that applied to people in the past. But today, people are thinking about a literal mark. Thus, when we find people in our time who think about Revelation, when they see the mark of the beast, what are they expecting? They're expecting a literal mark. They think that somebody's actually going to brand that on the right hand, or people are going to be running around and having some kind of literal mark. And there's no evidence for that, in the ancient world or even now. They did have a seal that was sometimes put on slaves, that was sometimes put on soldiers. But again, the idea that people have today, simply no evidence for it, at least none that I've ever found. Now, as we think about this particular mark of the beast, it is something in our day and time that has received a lot of attention. I first started to, follow this with some interest in the early 80s. And have been doing that for about 30 years, and it's kind of interesting to see what has taken place. Some in the class are a little younger than I am, some are a little older, and maybe with some combined knowledge we can put some of these things together. But anybody know what in the past, and maybe now, some people have associated with the mark of the beast? Particular item, they say, that's the mark. And you can see that. Coupons, World War II, sign up form. And if you didn't sign up?
You didn't get
them. Yeah.
And the children, they had to sign up for shoes because they needed shoes. And if you didn't sign up, you didn't get those coupons.
Okay. Very easy for people to run over here to Revelation 13 and say, aha, this is the mark of the beast. So that's one good example. What else? Scott?
There's a thing now that President Obama actually put in his State of the Union, like not the one, the speech, but the document to say that doctor, then you would like Americans to start putting computer chips either in their hand or somewhere on their body.
Right. And I think with the healthcare changes, whether you like them or not, you're probably going to find some people that are going to say, this is the mark of the beast, this is 666, with the huge changes, because healthcare, affects about everybody. So once again, it's not going to be a big leap for that. Other people have taken Social Security numbers and said, that's the mark of the beast. You're not going to be able, and really, if you don't have a Social Security number in this particular day and time, it's very, very difficult to do a lot of things. Going to be very difficult to get a job. It's going to be very difficult to file taxes and some other things. So people have said that's it. If you go back into the, Bonnie, was that your answer?
No, UPC codes.
Okay, that was going to be next on my list. And that was back in probably the early 80s. Again, I don't remember exactly when UPC codes, they probably were in the late 70s that they were introduced. That's maybe a little bit before then. But in the 80s, people were thinking because they were so common, you had the barcodes, and they were funny-looking symbols to people in that day and time, and they didn't know exactly how the symbol was broken down. So it was okay. That is the mark of the beast. People can do a lot of interesting things. Even dates. If you go back and you could do a little quick math, 1988, if you divide that by 3, guess what you come up with? 666. So sometimes people have done various dates. I mentioned to a couple people recently, back in 1933, prior to my time, there were some who claimed that the mark was also, looking forward to that particular time. There was a blue eagle. You can go back and do some internet looking. There was the National Industrial Recovery Act, and that was tied in with the time of Roosevelt. There was a special code of fair compensation, and it's a blue eagle. There are still some pictures of it that you can find on the net. I don't have one to pass out, but there was this vivid blue eagle. And if you were a merchant that was authorized to sell, you had this blue eagle in your store. You had this mark. And people who were not authorized to sell didn't have the eagle, and people who were buying from various businesses, they were encouraged to buy from merchants who only had that sign. So once again, a lot of people believe the Bible, and not a very big leap for them to say, well, hey, there's the mark. Don't buy or sell. Well, after a couple years, this, of course, was discontinued, and then, the interest in that kind of dropped off. Today, as we think about 666, we've got a lot of superstition. Go down to the license bureau, and they say, well, okay, we've got your plate for you, 66692. You think some people would walk out the door with that plate? There'd be some people, I don't want that. They may not know very much about the Bible and religion, but 666 in their mind is pretty much a hex. And they would say, there's no way. I want that on my vehicle. Or somebody says, okay, we're going to give you a new phone number, 534-6662. A lot of people would freak out with that particular number. They'd say to the phone company, no, we just don't want a number, telephone number with three sixes in it. Sometimes, I wouldn't want to sell a house that had 666 in the address. 6665 Main Street. I think you'd probably lose some buyers. They might love the house, but, they would say, well, that's the mark of the beast house. And there's no way that I want to be there. So people, once again, because really it's a lack of Bible knowledge, you find a lot of concern about this. We've said repeatedly in this particular class, what kind of language do we have in the book of Revelation? It is figurative language. It is symbolic language. Well, if that's true, then as we're dealing with this mark, as we're dealing with the beast, and as we're dealing with 666, what should we be thinking? These things are not literal. The problem is not 666 and a driver's license and a license plate or a telephone number or anything else. In fact, if you look at the next chapter, and this amazes me that people will get so focused here at the end of Revelation 13, but they'll not look at the very next verse, Revelation 14:1. And I saw and behold the Lamb standing on the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his name and the name of his Father, what? Written on their forehead. Nobody's upset about that. When you begin to look at Revelation 14:1 and how Revelation 13 ends, you kind of get pointed towards a conclusion. Will we expect the written on the forehead to be literal? My name's Bonnie. I'm a child of God. I've never seen that now. I don't think we're going to see that in heaven, where everybody's got a big stamp up there. It's a statement that's literal or figurative? Figurative statement. This person belongs to God. Well, if it's figurative for the saved, it's also probably figurative, symbolic for the unsaved. So if people would just read a little further in the text, I think it would greatly help them. And what he's saying here is that our relationship with God determines whether we have the mark of the beast or whether we have the mark of God. There are two marks. We've said repeatedly that when you look at the book of Revelation, it is, by and large, a document which says the same stuff as we have elsewhere in the New Testament. Just symbolic language. Well, isn't that true? When we think about the saved having a mark, the mark of God, the name of God inscribed in them, how else is that described in the New Testament? Well, they do. They do. But let me ask my question in a different way. Here we've got two marks. The mark of the beast, the mark of God. Other passages would refer to people as the saved and the lost. We've got people who follow the light and people who follow the darkness. What are some of the other ways that God designates these two things? All right, you can follow Satan or you can follow Christ. All right, you've got the lambs and you've got the sheep and the goats. That would be another one. What else?
Your actions speak louder
All right, you know, you've got the fruit of the Spirit. You've got the works of darkness, the actions. What else? There's truth and there's...
untruth.
Okay, untruth or there's error. You've got the sons of God. You've got the sons of, you know, darkness, the devil. So this stuff is, as I say, not new at all. The central issue, as one said in Revelation 13, 16, 18, is not 666 or the mark of the beast, but it is who will be your master. Is it going to be God or is it going to be this world? And many years before, remember Jesus said, Matthew 6, 24, a man can have only how many masters? One. You're either going to be here, you're going to be with God, or you're going to have your foot over here in the world. Not to my knowledge. I think, and the approach that I'm going to take next week is 666. It goes back to the significance that numbers had. You know, for example, 7 is completeness, perfection. 6 has a different connotation. We also mentioned the 10, which won't be the focus of that discussion, but 10, completeness, just like we have 10 fingers and 10 toes. But 6, that lack of perfection, completeness, and ultimately evil. So... but with the money, I think the primary point there would be that emperors had their image stamped on there, and they were known as deity. They were referred to as God, and for the Christian, that really would have been objectionable. Let me show you this, too. We'll look ahead a little bit. But verse 18, here's wisdom. He that hath understanding, let him count the number of the beast, for it will be. No, he says, for it is. Well, what tense is? Past, present, or future?
Present.
It's present. So as John is writing this, and you can also see, I think, this information in verse 17 as well, you know, he uses the present tense. Well, what's that tell us about this particular mark in the beast? A future thing for us? He wasn't talking about UPC codes and the Social Security Act. Is. Puts us back in John's day and time. So... that's one more way. It's a quick way to help us realize that John is not talking about something in the future. He's talking you know, about things in the past. Now, Rome, we're in Revelation 13, verses 16 through 18, if you've just joined us. They were very hostile to God's people. This has also been true of other cultures. You can skip over. I'm going to read from Hebrews chapter 10, verses 32 through 34, especially verse 34, to show you that in the first century, and once again, not only limited to that time, but in the first century, God's people faced very, very difficult circumstances at times. The writer says, Hebrews 10:32, but call to remembrance the former days, in which after ye were enlightened, ye endured a great conflict of sufferings. He says, you faced some tough times. There was persecution. Then he says, partly being made a gazing stock. People were looking at you by reproaches and afflictions, and partly becoming partakers with them, that they were so used. And then verse 34, for ye both had compassion on them that were in bonds. What did some of the persecution, verse 32, involve? Some of the people were confined, locked up, imprisoned. And then he says, and took joyfully the spoiling of your possessions. So there were Christians who, because of persecution, they were not only carted off to prison, but what about their possessions? Taken away. Just like there are the spoils of war, you go in and if you conquer a people, you get to take what they, you know, have. That's happened many times. Well, this was also what was taking place for many Christians. You think about what it would have been like for a Christian in the first century. And once again, relating this to the mark of the beast, how difficult it was. If you're a Christian business owner, you're not comfortable using Roman currency. That's what you have to do. Then you have to have that certificate. What's going to happen to your business? Yeah. You know, today there's talk about stifling business because of various regulations. Imagine trying to follow a regulation which says you've got to deny your God. Very tough. I mean, you can literally be squeezed out of business. So, you know, you might have some brethren buy from you, but blackballed in the community. Now, if you go back in some of the earlier chapters of Revelation, let's take a peek back in Revelation 2 and 3. It seems to me that in the early parts of this book, we have some hints that relate to what we find over here in Revelation chapter 13. Revelation 2, verse 9, John said, I know thy tribulation. Okay? There's great hardship. Now, he doesn't, up to this point, explain why that is. But then he says, and thy poverty. Why were they poor? He doesn't explain. But if this passage is linked with Revelation chapter 13, you can kind of see a connection. They were enduring tribulation because of what Rome required. And because of that, you know, there were some people who were really poor. It was difficult to get through life day by day. And then in the third chapter, Revelation chapter 3, verses 17 and 18, he says, "Because thou sayest, I'm rich, I've gotten riches, and I have need of nothing, and knowest not that thou art wretched, you're miserable, you're poor, you're blind, you're naked. The Lord said, I counsel thee to buy from me gold refined by fire, that thou mayest become us rich." Now, it might take a second to connect this to Revelation 13. I think it's fairly easy to do. Here's a situation where Christians, they're going through that persecution. But now you have a group, they're doing great. Why might they be doing so well when everybody else is suffering? Well, okay. But remember what Rome is saying you got to do? A lot of people, Revelation 2:9, are standing up to Rome and saying, we're not going to do it. But do you think that there probably were some people that were saying, well, okay, got to provide for the family, so we'll pinch a little incense, we'll cave in, we'll do what Rome wants. You think there were some brethren? I imagine that there were. And if you were willing to do that, what would that do to your financial prosperity? Help you or hurt you? It's going to help you. And here, the Lord says, you're rich. Why? Maybe because they caved into Rome. And when you look at that warning, God says you're not rich. You're poor. Why? Maybe because they made the wrong choice. Maybe because spiritually they were denouncing Christ to go ahead and make sure that they were not going to suffer much when it came to economic circumstances. So can't be 100% sure, but when you go back and you look at Revelation 2 and 3, this seems to be something that may have been taking place there. Throughout time, there have been people who have had to make the same kind of choice. Are you going to be willing to give up your possessions for Christ? Are you willing to suffer to the point where you're willing to lay down your life for the cause of Christ? You're called on to make a choice. And there's no way to straddle the fence. You will have to choose one or the other. And God says, which way are you going to take? Well, people being people, some will say, we will not turn away from Christ. We're willing to surrender our possessions. We're willing to be a martyr for Christ. And in other cases, you find some people who are simply going to be lost. And once again, we then, at that point, have the mark of the beast because we've done what Satan and his forces want us to do, or we have the mark of God. As we look at this information, we really have an interesting cast of characters in this chapter as well as the chapters that follow. And as we look at this, it's really an ongoing battle between good and evil. And part of this, John says in Revelation 13, verses 16 and 17, is understanding things. Where was that? Yeah, it's in the end of 17. He that hath the mark, even the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Now, when you think about this, there is a good parallel to Revelation chapter 19, verse 12. A lot of people, and we'll turn over there in just a second, a lot of people, when they talk about this, they say, well, okay, what's the name of the beast? Or what's the number of his name? Well, Revelation 19 will help us, I think, in this regard, as far as trying to figure out this part of John's point. Revelation 19, 12 says, and his eyes are a flame of fire, and upon his head are many diadems. And he hath a name written, which no one knoweth but himself. All right, the Lord has a name. Nobody knows it but the Lord. But then as you continue reading, what's said in verse 13? All right. Yeah, he says you can't know the name, and then he turns right around in verse 13 and says, well, his name is the Word of God. Then if you go down a little bit, verse 16, what do we find there? Okay, once again, you want to know who the Lord is? John says, I'm going to give you a name. So when he talks about, over here in Revelation 13, having some knowledge as far as the name or the number of the beast, I don't think we're dealing with a literal name. Somebody says, well, what's your name? Is it John, Sue, Joe, Henry, what is it? That's normal how we understand that. But here, Revelation 19, Revelation 13, when he talks about understanding the name, rather than describe a literal name, it seems to describe what? I need to understand your character, your disposition, a comprehension of who you are. Well, that's why you don't have in Revelation 19 just one name. You know, what is he? He's the King of Kings He's the Lord of Lords. He's the Word of God as far as Jesus' character. And that's the same point in Revelation 13. In describing the name, it's the character. It's the composition of this particular beast. And that fits very well as far as several general things throughout time. You can deal with the things in the first century, but also in later times. So, as Steve mentioned in his opening prayer, things that we can apply throughout the Christian era. Steve?
And just reading this, I was trying to understand. Like, if you go back to verse 15, it says, he was granted the power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause many that would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. So if you're talking about character, then these people in that time would have to, whoever maybe the ruler was at this time, look at him as God. Is that, am I reading that?
I think that would be part of the point.
And if you didn't, then you were persecuted. Basically, you didn't have that number.
Yes, if you refuse. Let's put it in today's terms. Because if we want to apply it throughout time, we need to look at it somehow today. One example comes to my mind. You may have some others. But if we don't follow the world's mold today, we may not suffer economically, but we're probably verbally going to suffer some abuse. What mold is the world trying to squeeze us into today? The world says, you believe this or else we're going to come after you somehow. All right, that's one thing. If you stand up and you're judgmental, for example, you say this is right, this is wrong. What else?
Well, there was a movement a few years back under President Clinton that he wanted to, before any student graduated from high school, have to go through a sensitivity training towards homosexuality and had to sign a paper or you couldn't get your diploma. Well, it failed, obviously, but he was pushing for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, how can you deny someone 13 years in kindergarten through 12th grade their diploma if they refuse to sign that paper?
Yeah. Well, sensitivity training is becoming a bigger and bigger part of the workplace. Anybody gone through that as far as work? All right, one, two, three, so not too many so far. But it is a big thing, and there have been some Christians who have been basically pressured. If you want to go ahead and keep your job, you have to believe this or you have to do this. With our society, sticking with the theme of homosexuality, if you stand up in opposition to it, you're going to have a flood of hate and maybe some death mail. And our world says you need to accept this definition for marriage. And once again, it's going to be before the Supreme Court in about a week. And if you don't accept this, we're going to come after you. And again, Steve, it may not be the same degree. You know, they may not cut us off economically, they may not imprison us, they may not kill us, but still, opposition to the world, it is absolutely consistent with this particular principle. You see this flow of evil that comes down from either apostate religion or an evil secular government, and the devil wants to squeeze you into that mold, and Christians have to make a choice, just like they were doing 2,000 years ago. Glenda? And one of the lessons, one of the practical lessons from Revelation 13 is that Satan's very good at what he does. He will use false religion. He will use secular power to try to enforce his will on people. And he's not opposed to even using economic hardship to oppress God's people. They always talk about when people get in, you know, hitting a wallet, that's when they really start to pay attention. There's some truth in that statement. The devil knows that. And if he can't get you from the various temptations in the world, he's also willing to hit you economically. And in this particular case, it was not just one person or a handful of people or a congregation that was being hit economically. I mean, you have a whole nation full of people. He says, let's go after these Christians. Let's get, you know, the money involved with false religion. Let's get the certificates where you have to worship the emperor as God. Otherwise, we're going to shut you down from buying, selling, trading. And it was a rough, rough time. But God still said to his people, you be faithful and I will see you through it. It may not be easy. And you may end up losing your life. You may lose some property. But remember what Jesus said, Revelation 2:10, be faithful unto death, even if that's what's required. So it says you hang in there regardless of the price, regardless of the cost, and it's going to be worthwhile. We still need to hear that message today. Anybody else? Okay, let's make another quick point here. the final verses in the chapter, there is some difficulty here. When we think about what Peter wrote, 2 Peter 3:16, he said some of what Paul wrote is hard to understand, and that's also true for what John has to say. But as we look at this information, I just want to touch on the first part of verse 18. John said, here is what?
Wisdom.
Well, you might scratch your head and think, well, I'm not sure how wise that is. But when somebody says, here's wisdom, for that to be wisdom, is that something that you can sort of understand, or is that just something you say, well, that's just too deep for me, let's go on to other stuff? By the very nature, what's wisdom? It's information that we profit from, isn't it? Wisdom is information we learn from. Now, somebody may give us some wisdom, but may we have a full comprehension of it? We can give some great advice, some wise advice to young folks. And they might say, well, okay, that kind of makes sense to me. But it may take a while before they really begin to realize just how wise and how good that advice is. But still, there is some understanding of it. Now, to me, that's what John is saying here. There may be a little bit of difficulty here, but you can have some comprehension of what's being described. And that's why we've tried to outline in at least some general terms some of the things that were taking place and some practical points for today. So we've got to get at least the big picture. Well, that makes sense. If you go back to the first chapter in Revelation, always good to kind of remember where we were way back when. John said, Revelation 1:3, blessed is he that readeth, and they that hear the words of the prophecy, that is the book of Revelation. And after he talked about reading and hearing, he also said, and they that keep. Well, if we're going to keep, or if we're going to obey information, what's necessary? We have to understand it. I mean, we can't keep a law, we can't follow or obey a law unless we have a comprehension of it. So, Revelation 1:3, Revelation 13:17, we can get enough out of here to go ahead and apply some things in our daily lives. Another point that comes out of here, and this is more based on 16 than 17, let's go back and look at that little word again. And he causes how many people? All. What's that tell us about the devil? Who's he interested in? All people. You know, he's interested in the people that are really involved in the church. He's interested in the people that are slightly involved in the church. And every person out there in the world. He's interested in their soul as well. Sometimes Christians are not interested in every soul. But God is. And so is the devil. So as we go through life, we want to make sure that we pay attention to him. Let's see. Well, that was all I wanted to say about that. Anything that you want to add or ask, or what we've talked about so far? Glenda?
I was going to say, is this a system for a man? Because the beast is called it, and then at the end it's called he.
Yeah. I think system is probably a good word for that. Some people will try to identify it as a specific.
You've got Rome, and then from Rome all there.
Right.
And then the Roman Catholic Church. I'm just throwing this out there.
Yeah. You have, once again, we have two beasts in Revelation 13. You've got evil civil authority, you've got apostate religion. Apostate religion seems to be the focus of what we have here in 16 through 18 when he talks about he. I think it's going back to that second beast. And, you know, if you were willing to involve yourself in the apostate religion, recognizing the emperor as God, then you could get your certification. You wouldn't have any problems with the coinage and so forth. But if you had some difficulties in that area, then you face the consequences that were negative. So, but it is, as you mentioned, you've got the head, if you will, and all the negative consequences that flow down.
Do you guys still have that now?
I don't know of any.
The Catholics, I mean, they see as God, you know, the figure of Christ. And
I don't think that they would call him God. Jesus' representative, you know, his personal representative on the earth, but they probably wouldn't, you know, refer to him as deity. Now, when you're, you know, kissing the feet or kissing the hand of somebody, unless that's a romantic gesture, when you, well, obviously it wouldn't be in this particular circumstance, but unless that's a romantic gesture, you know, or a greeting, I mean, and you're bowing down before somebody, that's reverend at best. And, you know, at worst, you're acknowledging that that person, you know, is deity. I mean, when you bow before a person and do those kinds of things, you're associating with them some degree, some level of holiness that's far beyond man. Now, biblically, I can't find, as far as holiness, any distinction between humanity and deity. I mean, once you go above man, you know, angels are certainly not worthy of that kind of attention. And Peter didn't accept it in Acts chapter 10. And if the apostles were not worthy of it, then what man could be? Well, when you refer to someone as, you know, the personal representative, right, when you say that someone is a personal representative of someone, obviously it's not the same person. But you, as far as status and authority, they're pretty close. When you're talking about God, you know, the Bible pictures, well, in Hebrews chapter 1, it says, what is man that thou art mindful of him? Going back to the Old Testament and pulling out an Old Testament citation. So how you get a man to the point where he's basically nothing, up to the point where he's Christ's personal representative, again, just no biblical support for that. So, and when we looked at 1 Corinthians 12, 28, you know, last week, you know, the Bible says the apostles were put first in the church. So you just, you know, be on shaky ground at that particular point. Anybody else? All right, Revelation 13, 18 is the last verse. We talked about the first part of it, and there's just too much there, but I will go ahead and make a couple of preliminary comments. John says, not only hear his wisdom, but he says, he that hath understanding. Well, that doesn't mean you need to be the biggest and the brightest to understand this, but it's another way of saying, this is information that you can have some understanding of. Let him count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666, or 666. My plan is, next week we'll have a whiteboard, and I want to lay out some things. I may not be right as far as 666, but I'm going to lay out what comes out to 666, and you know, I may be incorrect, but if you've never seen this, and I doubt anybody in the class has, at least the approach that I'm going to take to the text, it should be insightful. So you can kind of compare that with maybe with what you've learned from the past, or if you're doing some current reading, what you're looking at right now, and give that some consideration. So it should be pretty easy to follow, and you know, at least it'll point us in a direction that's consistent with what John wrote. But for those in the first century, it was a very, very difficult time. And as we look at how things are progressing in our day and time, we may, not to the same point, but still have some great difficulties because of where our culture is.